You're listening to a Share Radio podcast. The Investment Trust Show, brought to you by Henderson Global Investors, managing investment trusts since 1934.
Time now for our regular weekly programme, The Investment Trust Show, brought to you in association with Henderson Global Investors. Each week we explore the main features, factors and developments affecting investment trusts. And this week we're going to be taking a look at the rather critical issue of risk. Now, this of course applies to all investments in general, not just investment trusts. And to help us understand risk, we're joined by Martin Bamford from Informed Choice, as well as Share Radio's senior analyst Ed Bauscher. Martin, how important is it that people understand their own individual risk when deciding how to invest?
Well, from a financial planning perspective, I think risk is everything, and it's all about how much risk you want to take with your money, but also how much risk you feel able to take. And the really critical one I think a lot of people overlook is how much risk you actually need to take to reach certain financial objectives.
Perhaps you could amplify this more. I mean, are we thinking about the way in which the risk you might take would change as you go through life and approach retirement?
That's a key one. Certainly the received wisdom is as you get older, as you approach retirement, you want to take less risk with your money. I think that concept to some extent has been completely turned on its head in recent years, in part because of pension freedoms. And one of the reasons people took less risk as they got older, got closer to retirement, was because they tended to annuitize. They tended to take an invested portfolio, an invested pension, and buy an annuity. And the other reason, of course, is we're all living so much longer. And because we're living longer, we need our money to last for longer. And one way to make it last for longer is to take more risk and hopefully get higher returns.
Mm-hmm. As you mentioned it, is the buying an annuity, is that really almost a thing of the past at the moment until interest rates normalise?
It's still suitable for some people, particularly older retirees. It's often not the thing to do as soon as you reach retirement. So using flexibility, using income drawdown when you reach retirement often makes more sense. But for older people where the annuity rates still can look attractive in some cases, and also for people with any medical conditions, health or lifestyle issues where they can qualify for a higher enhanced annuity rate, that makes a lot of sense too.
Now, one of the aims in setting up Share Radio was to improve financial education. How important is financial education, particularly understanding, I mean, it's not just the question of risk, but as we hear in all those adverts, the fact that, you know, you can lose money when you're investing in the stock market as well as gaining money. Is financial education important? Do you feel that it's not sufficient, that people don't even leave school understanding really how the world of investment works?
We've got absolutely terrible levels of financial education in this country generally speaking. Now, a lot of people, particularly listeners to Share Radio, will have higher levels of financial education than others. They'll be aware of all of the concepts. I think most of us are aware that the value of our investments can go down as well as up. We've heard that risk warning drummed into us so many times in the past. But as soon as you get into more detail and you try and understand the risk of different types of investment assets, then we really do find investment knowledge, financial education is lacking.
You mentioned we're very bad in this country. Do you happen to know, are there other countries that do this sort of thing much, much better than this? Are there examples that we ought to try and copy?
I don't off the top of my head. I know that financial education in schools here in the UK is improving, and we've got bodies like PFEG, the Personal Financial Education Group, who are trying to improve things. Certainly in America, there seems to be a much more a broader financial literacy movement, and there's podcasters over there. There are evangelists on TV and radio, syndicated radio stations and columnists who are really driving the message of financial responsibility, financial education home. So in America, certainly they are streets ahead when it comes to general financial knowledge compared to here in the UK.
So we talked about risk. I mean, how do investors decide whether to invest themselves or to invest with trust managers? What are the key differences? Though, of course, it may well be a blend of things. You may feel you're able to invest directly in, for instance, UK companies that you can understand and can read about, but you may want to use managers for overseas investments, for instance, or certain sectors.
Yeah, absolutely. I think for the majority of retail investors in this country, actually buying your own stocks and shares portfolio is possibly a thing of the past. I think buying through collective investment funds, whether that's a unit trust or an open-ended collective investment, or it's an investment trust or a closed-ended fund, I think that tends to be the route most people take to the market now. Where we come across clients who have got stocks and shares, directly held stocks and shares, it's often because they've inherited them from a parent or grandparent, or because they've had a windfall from demutualization. So it's not usually a choice to go out there and buy your own blue chip stocks and actually build your own share portfolio. For most people, and that's really an economy of scale thing. If you've got a modest investment portfolio, anything up to, I guess, £500,000, even higher, up to £1 million, there's no real economy of scale to go out and try and pick and choose your own individual company shares. You're much better off allowing a professional fund manager to do that job for you.
I think the other thing I'd say, Simon, on that is I think, you know, with do-it-yourself investors, I mean, it can work. It does work well for some people, but they almost inevitably start focusing on particular parts of the market, particular sectors they're interested in. And so I think they lose out on some of the benefits of diversification and, as a result, increase the risk a little bit there. But, of course, we must remember, and I'm sure Martin agrees with me completely, is that, you know, yes, fine, collective funds do make sense for many retail investors, whether they're investment trusts or unit trusts, but there still is a lot of risk when you invest in those funds as well, especially if you're investing for the short term. If you're investing for 5 years or more, 10 years, 20 years, when there's a much greater chance of the stock market doing well, then that long-term investing reduces the risk somewhat.
And also, of course, the fact that there are simply so many of them. Even if you take a particular sector, you're presented with an immense amount of choice and you're having to go, by and large, on past performance or fame of certain fund managers. But as we all know, we talk about investments can go down as well as up, and past performance is no guide to future performance. How, Martin, then, do people cope? I mean, you talked about the risk profile earlier, but there is this question then of the extraordinary array of choice.
So much choice, absolutely. A big challenge for investors at the moment is trying to pick the most suitable investment fund to suit their needs, really. There are more investment funds in this country than there are individual listed stocks and shares. So you're faced with so much more choice if you want to go out there and buy a fund manager. I think the starting point is always come back to the financial planning. What do you want to achieve with your money? How much risk do you need to take in order to achieve certain financial goals? And then obviously make sure you're prepared to take that much risk and you can afford to take that much risk. We call that capacity for risk. So once you've decided how much risk you need to take, you can design a portfolio. And our starting point for portfolio design is always asset allocation. So the broad type of investments you're going to go into. UK equities, international equities, bonds, property, etc.
So this is getting over the problem that Ed mentioned further, that you'd simply, I don't know, you might just simply invest in UK retailers that you know of, and then of course you're completely exposed to them and have no diversification.
Yeah, lack of diversification is a huge risk. And actually, if we're talking about trying to reduce risk in investment portfolios, time is a really good one. So as Ed mentioned, the longer you invest for, the less of a risk it is. But diversification is key as well. If you mix and match your portfolio, don't just rely, for example, on blue chip UK equities, but have some fixed interest in there too, have some commercial property. The more diversification you get, the less risk you're taking effectively, but you don't reduce the potential for long-term investment returns.
The other thing I'd just like to add in quickly, you talked about capacity for risk there, Martin. I think sort of following on from that, people need to think about their own personality. You know, objectively, you might be someone who's actually got huge capacity for risk. You're quite young. You're quite well off anyway. But if you've got the personality where you're going to stay up fretting every night about your investment in your carefully chosen portfolio of OEICs and investment trusts, then maybe you need to adjust to a safer portfolio because you just can't cope with having that risk. And the worries that is affecting you also actually might force you to make poor investment decisions because you sort of start selling as soon as share prices fall. So I do think it's important to think about your personality as well.
Yeah, absolutely. The behavioural side of the investing is just becoming coming to the fore now. Whereas before we used to view investing as very mechanical and lacking emotion entirely. Behavioural investing now is so, so important. The last thing you'd want to do is invest in a portfolio that was giving you sleepless nights. So, yeah, definitely tailor investment risk to your personality.
It sounds as though investors might need a psychologist as well as a financial advisor, from what you say, Martin.
Well, we hopefully do a bit of both. And I think a really important part of the value we add as financial advisors is not just picking and choosing the most suitable funds or helping people to design their own financial plans, but it's this behavioral coaching. It's helping people stay invested throughout market dips. You know, if I can convince one client to not have a knee-jerk reaction and try and sell everything because the markets are volatile, then long term, they're going to really gain from that advice.
I suppose, of course, there's this investment principle averaging out that if you continue investing and putting money into the market in dribs and drabs, that you will be investing in bad times as well as good times, and ultimately your cost of your investments will be lower. I mean, Ed, you've mentioned this many times, this idea that when the market is falling is not the right time to be selling, but if you're brave enough, perhaps the time to be buying. And we certainly saw that perhaps in the mid-2016 after the Brexit vote.
We did. We saw that very quickly. And we also saw it actually in early 2016 when, for other reasons, the FTSE was down to about 5,500 for a little while. That was a good opportunity. But of course,
we were told the world was about to end then.
We were. And that's the thing. The difficult thing is you kind of do need to feel quite brave to buy in when markets appear to be low. And so that's why the process that I think you alluded to there, Simon, of pound cost averaging, of just investing, let's say, £500 a month, every month, month after month, that will mean that you will at least be buying some shares when markets are low, some when they're higher. But of course, £500 when they're low will buy more shares than £500 when you're high. And at least you're getting some exposure to when markets are perhaps too low on a rational basis.
Well, we'll be back in a moment, and we then will look at the opportunities and advantages, if indeed such is what Martin decides, of investment trusts.
The Investment Trust Show, brought to you by Henderson Global Investors, managing investment trusts since 1934.
We're talking to Martin Banford from Informed Choice. With me in the studio, Show Radio senior analyst Ed Bauscher. Martin, let's now look at investment trusts. What are the advantages and possible disadvantages of investment trusts compared to other forms of collective fund that you've mentioned?
That's a great question. I think the main one is that you have this opportunity to, well, two things really. Firstly, an opportunity to buy in at a discount, because the price you pay for an investment trust isn't just about the underlying assets within the investment trust. It's about investor sentiment too. So if investor sentiment for a particular trust is poor at a time, you can buy at a bit of a discount, and then your gain in the future can effectively be increased, it can be multiplied. The other thing is that investment trusts have the ability to borrow. They can leverage investment returns. So when things are going well and returns are good, that's a great, you know, boost to your investment returns.
I would just chip in here, Simon. I mean, yes, leverage can boost your returns, but if things go wrong, of course, leverage can boost your losses, but it still is an attractive thing. And the point that Martin was making about the discounts, absolutely valid. The point that share prices of investment trusts normally aren't the same as the value of the underlying portfolio. Often the share price is lower, and that gives you discounts, which can sometimes be quite large.
I mean, that's often mentioned, of course, but I suppose the only reason that's going to be a big advantage is if the discount does disappear further down the line.
Indeed,
if the discount remains, then there's no particular advantage.
It remains, or of course it may even widen. And so actually, even if the value of your underlying portfolio has fallen 15%, the value of the share price might fall by 20% if the discount widens. So extra rewards potentially, but also extra risk.
Martin, going back to what we discussed right at the beginning, you talk about the risk profile of individual investors. So investors who are looking for investment trusts that are perhaps relatively low risk, what sort of characteristics should they be looking for? I mean, we've mentioned gearing, for instance. I mean, a company that is gearing as much as it can will probably not be considered very low risk. But what other signs are there that an investment trust might be a relatively low risk one?
Yeah, spot on. I think a highly geared investment trust is probably not going to be suitable for a low risk investor. There's a really difficult question at the moment about what is risk in the market and what is low risk. I think traditionally investment trusts, which were, I guess, in UK equity incomes, tend to be quite stable, quite defensive over the long term. But the market is in just such a state of flux at the moment. We've got high equity valuations. We've got very low gilt yields. I think for low risk, cautious investors, just trying to find a low risk home for your money is a real, real challenge today.
I mean, there are trusts out there, aren't there, Martin, that actually instead of having leverage, they actually have cash, which they're just leaving in a bank account. Is that too low risk an approach, or does it make sense if you are worried that markets are too high, or you just don't want to take too much risk yourself?
I've never really seen the sense for an investor in picking a fund that's got a high cash balance. And somewhere we often see this is within commercial property funds. And we've seen cash balances as high as 40%. And obviously it's important for certain types of funds to have that liquidity, because when lots of investors sell, certainly for open-ended funds, not so much on investment trusts, which are closed-end, but if investors are selling, they need to have cash available to pay those investors without having to sell assets. So I think if you want to hold money in cash, if that's the right risk profile for you as an investor, hold it in cash. Don't try and choose a fund that's the manager for some reason has decided to hold some cash within the fund, because you've just lost control over your risk management. You've handed that risk management to a fund manager who's making those decisions for you. You're better off if it's not right for you to invest, don't invest.
You said earlier that the idea that as our lives progress, we get closer to retirement, that we might want to lower risk has been complicated by the fact that the whole issue of what risk is these days has been turned on its head. But I guess that people, when they're new to investing in the market or in collective funds, investment trusts and so on, they'll tend to be younger people, I guess, who are beginning to dip their toe into water. So they're going to have less money to begin with, and presumably, therefore, that also will affect how they want to invest. I mean, if you're just starting out investing, presumably diversification is difficult except through something like an investment trust.
Yeah, I'd agree entirely. I think if you're just getting started, going for any collectives at all where you've got that spread of risk, that spread of diversification is really, really valuable. But also if you're young and you're prepared to leave the money alone, this goes back to this behavioural finance we talked about before the break. If you're prepared to just ignore it, prepared to ignore the market valuations, the stock market crashes, you're in such a strong position because you can just put money in, hopefully on a regular basis, and benefit from the pound cost averaging Ed referred to, and just leave it to grow, because over the very long term, it will grow.
And of course, many share dealers now will allow you to invest in investment trusts at relatively low cost, just putting in small amounts each time. It used to be that because they are actually traded vehicles themselves, that it was quite expensive buying a relatively small amount of investment trust. But that's changed a lot, hasn't it? That most trusts you can now put relatively small amounts in regularly.
Absolutely. I think this is one of the great benefits we've seen from technology in the investment space. You know, 25 quid a month, 50 quid a month as a regular investment. It's a low enough cost of entry for most investors to get started, even when you're very young and you've got competing financial priorities. You're trying to save a deposit for your first home, trying to repay student loans or credit card debts. I think most people out there who want to build wealth for the long term should be able to squirrel away at least £50 a month just to get started. And also, as well as wealth building, it's just a really good experience, I think, just to learn the mechanics of the investment trust, monitor performance, see what the fund manager's up to. So just putting your toe in the water with £25 or £50 a month is a really good place to start.
And what sort of advice would you offer somebody who's doing this to start with one trust, and then as you become slightly wealthier, you hope you through promotions and pay rises, you begin to add to your portfolio? Or do you think that there should be an element of diversification right from the beginning? And also, how should people be looking after these investments? Do you think they should be putting them into something like a SIP from the word go? Though you talk about they might need them for houses. So presumably money you put into something like a SIP is going to be difficult to take out if you need it during your lifetime. I mean, well, not your lifetime, sorry, your working lifetime.
To start with the first part, I think keep it simple at outset. I see far too many people come along and they have bought every single flavour of the month fund that they've seen in the newspaper at the weekend, or they've seen promoted by an investment platform. So they come to me with a list of 30 or 40 different funds. And when that happens, I do have some big concerns about their understanding of what they're doing, how the investment portfolio has been constructed. So start simple. Yeah, start with one investment trust. It's a really good place to start. I think once your portfolio goes above £5,000, £10,000, you can then look to some diversification, but you really don't need to when you're just getting started. On the second part, in terms of how you allocate that, I think ISAs are a really good thing. The tax advantage for an investor getting started now for an ISA isn't that great, because we've got the personal savings allowance, we've got the dividends allowance now. So there isn't a huge tax advantage for people outside of an ISA. It's more or less comparable. That said, it does keep it simple. You don't have to report it to HMRC each year, any income or gains. You don't have to do those calculations for the tax man. So I think using an ISA, keeping it accessible. So a SIP, whilst that's attractive, if you genuinely are saving for retirement for the very long term and you're prepared to lock it away to age 55, it may even be older in the future. I think we'll probably see that minimum age go up at some point. By all means, use a SIP, use a pension wrapper, and actually tailor that money for retirement. But otherwise, if you think you might need to get access to the money in the short or medium term, use an ISA.
Well, let's look at investors with a slightly more mature portfolio of investment trusts. those who might then considering that they're actually wanting to invest in funds that specialise in overseas or in emerging countries? What do you then tell them about things like currency risks and geopolitical risks?
As a financial advisor, as you can imagine, the risk warnings that we have to share with every single client are extensive. And certainly geopolitical risk, currency risk, all of these are considered and really well publicised. But more than that, more than just telling them a risk, we want them to understand it. So I often get clients to repeat it back to me and put it in their own words just to really make sure they understood the risks I was presenting to them. As soon as you move away from the UK equity markets, you're going to take on additional risks. I think trying to quantify those risks, if they are easy to quantify, if they're easy to see, then I'm less concerned. It's when we look at investment types where that risk is harder to understand, I get very, very nervous about my clients' money.
On currency risk, I mean, I think it is a valid risk. Obviously, you could invest in Japan and the yen could then fall and you know, your investments become less than you thought they would be in sterling.
Yes, I'm very familiar with that.
But over the long term, I think currency risk probably balances out. You might find, fine, your yen-based investments fall, but your dollar-based investments might rise. So as ever, over the long term, it may not be such a big deal, but you still absolutely need to be aware of it, and it may go against you if you're unlucky.
So that, Ed, is that sort of going back to what you said earlier about the fact that some investors will just simply look at their portfolio too often and be inclined to deal as a result, and if you're just patient, in the long term, most of these things that we've been talking about will balance out, well, providing you're in a reasonably dependable investment trust in the first place.
They'll probably balance out, yes.
Over the long term. Yes. You must say the word probably quite a good deal, Martin, I imagine.
Yeah, probably. We don't really deal in certainties. And I think as long as an investor, you accept that, you're in a good position.
We ought to talk about the downside. I mean, you know, markets go down as well as up. We're all very familiar with that here. Now, we had recently, at the time of the Brexit vote, certain forms of collective investments, people found they couldn't actually take money out. Now, with investment trusts, are you therefore much safer? Can you always withdraw money from an investment trust?
You're more likely to be able to sell your shares in an investment trust. But of course, as we mentioned earlier, that discount could widen. So if we did have a big market correction, if there was general fear amongst investors out there, you would expect a greater discount applied. So you could potentially have to sell if you were forced to sell, or if you felt you absolutely had to sell your holding at that time, you could be receiving a much lower value for it.
But as with any equity, you would imagine that you would still be able to trade. It's not going to be like some other form of sort of open-ended investment where they might simply have to close the ability to sell because they can't cope with all the people wanting to cash in.
No, absolutely. And the one we saw post-Brexit was open-ended funds invested in UK commercial property mainly, and they suspended redemptions.
Yes.
And they did it for a good reason, I think, to protect the investors who didn't panic, who didn't immediately try and withdraw money from the funds. Because had that happened, they would have had to have gone out there and sold big office blocks in London, you know, retail centres in the West Country, etc. Probably a bit of a fire sale situation. So they would have lost a lot of money on those sales, and all investors in the fund would have lost out as a result. So I think there are sometimes good reasons for suspending redemptions in a fund, in an open-ended fund. Of course, if you're the investor who's trying to take his or her money out at the time, it probably doesn't feel like a particularly good reason.
Yes, sadly, yet another thing of which I have personal experience, I confess. But, you know, that's the way we learn, I suppose, is through our mistakes. You just have to hope you don't make too many. But then sometimes mistakes seem to be good ones rather than bad ones. So, Martin, then, to sort of summarise, really, it is very important for investors to understand their risk. And I can't help feeling that, as Ed pointed out, with people investing in perhaps the wrong sector or specialising in one sector, that talking to somebody else is a better way of assessing your risk, perhaps, than just trying to look in the mirror and telling yourself you are a wonderful investor.
Yep, sometimes I think we get too close to our own investment portfolios. Getting that third-party impartial opinion is a really good way of understanding how much risk we're actually taking with our money rather than how much risk we've convinced ourselves we're actually taking.
Martin, thank you very much indeed for talking to us. Very interesting indeed. That is Martin Bamford from Informed Choice and, of course, Share Radio Senior Analyst. Ed Bauscher was in the studio as well. That's it for the Investment Trust Show, brought to you in association with Henderson Global Investors.
At Henderson Global Investors, we believe in helping people to make informed investment decisions by sharing our knowledge.
We are a proud sponsor of the Investment Trust Show on Share Radio, and we currently manage a range of 13 investment trusts in a wide range of sectors, geographies, and markets across the globe. Visit us at hendersoninvestmenttrusts.com. Henderson Global Investors is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority to provide investment products and services.